This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, I'm Carol Masser. Welcome to a special holiday weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. This week, some of the highlights from 2020 in a year that was like no other. A health pandemic, dual crises of racial and social injustice, fights for equality, and yeah, we had an election. It was a year filled with struggle and strife and with inspiration and innovation. Some of our memorable conversations included three leaders where sustainability is in their company's DNA. Jesper Brodén, President and CEO of Inca Group and IKEA on making the business case for climate action, plus Jenna Johnson of Patagonia on conscious sustainability, and then managing through a crisis with Chipotle CEO Brian Nickel. We begin with someone who understands real estate politics and making a difference to create a more equal and just world. Don Peoples is founder, chairman, and CEO of the Peoples Corporation, a privately held national real estate and development company. He's also worked for the Obama campaign and was former chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. Our conversation last fall began with a look at where we are in real estate.
You know, interestingly enough, we're still seeing a lot of tailwinds for single-family real estate. I think single-family homes are very strong. Interest rates are at historic lows, and so it's propelling a lot of buyers who are able to do that and take advantage of it or out in the market buying. So that continues to be a bright spot. I think we're seeing in some places what was very interesting is in Los Angeles. The condo sales market is actually doing well. And it's a surprising bright spot in the marketplace. And that's, again, because people want to get out of their cars. They want to live closer to where they work. And their economy is beginning to open back up. I think the challenge in the industry in real estate overall will be the obvious, which is retail, brick-and-mortar retail. And hospitality sectors are being very challenged right now. And hey, the office is kind of a wait and see right now.
Hey, Don, as you're well aware, there's this existential discussion going on, argument going on about the future of New York City. Does it have a future? How bright is it? What are your thoughts?
Well, of course, I think New York City definitely has a future, and it will always be a bright future. It's a city of 8.5 million people. That being said, about 100,000 residents have left Manhattan, which is a significant number out of 2 million residents. I think what we're seeing in New York, though, is a perpetuation and continuation of a trend that was beginning to happen before. And it started with the SALT. Once the state and local income tax deductions were taken away, it started encouraging more high net worth individuals to relocate to more tax-friendly environments. And then there was a diminishment of quality of life. The city got a bit dirtier. Crime was creeping up a little bit. And then with this pandemic, it has accelerated that. So I think on the high-end, ultra-luxury side, the residential market is going to struggle. The sales volume for residential condos is down significantly. And vacancy rates are at, you know, all-time highs. Right now, vacancy rates for apartments in Manhattan or New York City as a whole are over 5%, which is a very big number. And then there is about almost 20 million square feet of sublet office space. So we're seeing a shift. And what we're also seeing now is millennials coming of age, being married, having kids, and seeking out places that are more conducive to that, where the public school systems are more predictable and a little better quality of life and lower cost. So I think we're going to see a shift of what New York City looks like.
Well, so what does it also then mean for, you've got the gateway cities and then you've got secondary and tertiary cities. I mean, is that where you want to be investing at this point? Maybe not the gateway cities so much, or I don't know. How do you see it, Don?
Yeah, I think it's very challenging right now to make any kind of strategic long-term investment in New York City. I think if you look at the emerging markets, the ones that are what would be the tertiary cities that are emerging and are going to become much more dominant players, I would say Charlotte, North Carolina, has significant good news. Recently, they just got a new corporate relocation that's going to spend about $2 billion on a headquarters. You have Tennessee, especially Nashville, continuing to do well. South Florida is on a great run, both on the single-family side and attracting more entrepreneurial financial services firms down there. And some of the bigger banks are beginning to look at back of house down there as well. So I think that those types of markets, and then some of the other, I think Nevada is going to begin to pick up, and Texas is, you know, Austin's doing very well, will continue to do very well. I think it's the New York that, and the Chicago's, that are, and cities, the major gateway cities are going to struggle. Boston being an exception to that, because life sciences and the strong intellectual capital in that marketplace are saving it from what would be catastrophic results, like what New York is beginning to see right now.
So, Don, just quickly, tax, you mentioned the tax policy. What can states like New York and New Jersey and some others do? I mean, they just simply try to get more efficient?
A combination of things. I mean, I think that, I mean, New York has to recognize, and New Jersey has to recognize, that they are losing residents by the moment. I mean, we just launched a new private club in Miami Beach called the Bath Club, which is a private beach club. And we are getting, you know, flooded by applications of people coming from New York, relocating down, you know, just kind of almost spur of the moment. So they've got to sit. So New York, New Jersey have to recognize they've got to compete for residents. So they've got to be much more efficient and take a fresh look at what role the government has, especially in New York City. What is the role of a municipal government? It can't be everything to everybody. It's got to right size its workforce quickly. And this administration has been reluctant to do that. Mm. And then I think it has to think about longer term tax policy. New York should be in the business of reducing taxes and incentivizing job generation and productivity.
That was Peebles Corporation CEO Don Peebles. Don also served on the National Finance Committee of President Obama and was the former chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, from real estate to filling homes and buildings with sustainable goods, IKEA knows about that. We'll hear from Inca Group President and CEO Jesper Broden. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
Another conversation that stood out for us this year is a company and a leader who every day is making the business case for climate action. Inca Group President and CEO Jesper Broden, home to some 378 IKEA furniture and retail stores in 30 countries with more than 200,000 workers. He joined us from the Bloomberg Green Festival this year, and like so many of our conversations, we started off by talking about how his company has changed as a result of the pandemic.
For us, like for everybody on this planet, we have been through a very special journey this year. And I must admit, as I shared with you, to be traveling again, I felt a bit like the old movie Castaway when coming back to the office, seeing people and enjoying that also, I must say. At the same time, obviously, we, just like everybody else, have figured out new ways of leading. We have figured out that we didn't have a map for this situation, but we had a very strong compass, I think, with the way we like to lead and our values that helped us actually, I think, take many good decisions. But it's been a ride.
It's been a ride, no doubt about it. It's interesting that you say that, and we're going to get into kind of your sustainability strategy that is so much the IKEA and corporate culture here. But I do wonder, having so many of those measures in place, are there any specific anecdotes that you can tell us that helped you guys get through this crisis because of those green initiatives, those sustainable initiatives?
Well, you can say, I think it's all intertangled, right? People, planet, and business. And you can't take out any of these from the equation. So what happened, obviously, to us was that we had periods of dramatic closures in our stores. And we had to find ways to both protect ourselves, our people, our customers. And then on the other hand, we had to make sure that we could save the jobs for the future. And the way what actually happened in the end of the day was that we were speeding up everything around multi-channel and online. And we went from a good year to a record loss forecast to actually coming back on half of our estimated profit in the end of the day. And that was thanks to, I think, the entrepreneurship of getting things right quickly.
Do you think we're through it? Are you guys getting ready for another wave?
Well, you know, I think at a certain moment we were quite early on forecasting different scenarios. And the period that we have just entered, we called the new normal. And I think it's a bit of a deceptive term in a way, because the way we see it is that for at least a year to come, we need to be very agile, very prepared for outbreaks. I think the term second wave could be misunderstood. So we like to plan more for outbreaks and how to deal with that in the best possible way, both for jobs, for business, and for everything we do in society and contribute to. And obviously, it's clear for all of us that, you know, 1 year later again, it's still going to be learnings. There will be things that we will be, you know, doing differently, and there will be a lot of, I think, amazing things that we carry with us from this period as well, hopefully including the way we realize the importance of investment in sustainability and the opportunity of doing that right.
Well, let's get to that, because despite this being a crazy year, a tumultuous year, you guys are on track. And forgive me, I'm going to read from my notes because I want to get it right. You're on track to achieve and exceed a goal to produce as much energy from renewable sources as you consume by 2020. You have made massive investments, about 2.5 billion euro in wind and solar power. You've set a 2030 goal to be climate positive, meaning you're going to reduce more gas emissions than you emit. You are in, you know, when it comes to electric, 100% electric, 100% of the time, ahead of targets when it comes to deliveries in Shanghai by EVs. You're doing that in Amsterdam, LA, New York, Paris. And here's something, a goal for everyone who's listening. By 2030, mm-hmm. you guys have set, your ambition is to inspire and enable 1 billion people to live a better everyday life within the limits of the planet. It's really heady stuff, and it's impactful stuff. Mm-hmm. How tough has this been to do, and what has been the business case for climate change for you all?
Well, you know, I think if you look at IKEA's history, you can say we started out with a founder that was a very thrifty person, very smart right. around resources, and I think that's part of our story. So part of this, you know, that sustainability and being smart about people and planet is part of our legacy. My own story started back in 95 with the company when I joined in Asia Pacific at a time when we invested in, I think, what is still today an amazing code of conduct when it comes to production. Those days we had some discussions about, can we afford it? Will it drive costs to do the right thing with working hours, salaries, etc.? And in the end of the day, it turned out to be brilliant for business. We have the most efficient partners, happy co-workers along, etc. So I think we already then we saw some myths that were we needed to bust. And the same goes for the climate goals that we have committed to, where we do not have all the answers yet. So we still have some gaps to be filled the coming years. But we are convinced that this is good business for three reasons. Or you can say for two reasons. One is that our co-workers and our customers expect us to take the lead. So it would be, I would say, dangerous to not take that lead from your revenue side. But secondly, the business model we are building is the new low cost. So sustainability shows in case by case to be the way we will provide low price furniture in the future.
You say, you know what, a couple things. You said it was brilliant for the company. So I'm wondering if you can put some numbers on that in terms of the business case for doing all of this. But I also wonder, you said myths to bust, because I can only imagine some of the internal, you know, discussions, Jesper, that you folks had that said, no, we can't do that. I know it's good for the environment, but, you know, it's going to cost too much, or we can't recreate our supply chain. So give me a little bit of that feel.
No, but absolutely. I think the best number I can give you is that last year we were very happy and proud that we were able to grow with some 6% plus, which is a good, a decent IKEA year. And at the same time, we reduced our absolute carbon footprint across the whole scope 1, 2, and 3 with more than 4%. So it was possible to show healthy growth and at the same time decarbonize, if you like. Obviously, we are very humble and respectful to the future to continue that journey, which is the plan. But that was, the first year of proof for us. But then you can say to the myths, I think there are three myths that I see over and over again. One is that purpose and profit don't go hand in hand, which I think and we think is the opposite. there is a very strong myth that sustainability should come at a premium, which I think is very dangerous, because then this is a mass movement that needs to involve everybody on this planet. So therefore, it should be rather seen as the new low cost. And finally, there are a lot of myths around that consumption is all bad. And there is bad consumption, but there is also sustainable consumption. So these are the type of topics that sometimes lie in the way for taking the right type of action.
Purpose and profit don't go hand in hand. Well, dispelling some myths while also helping to create a more sustainable planet. That was Inca Group President and CEO Jesper Brodén. Coming up, staying on sustainability with another company that has made it a priority from its inception. We'll check in with Patagonia head Jenna Johnson. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
We're bringing you some of our memorable conversations from this year, some of the highlights, and we've heard from our past two guests a lot about sustainability. And when you think of conscious sustainability, one company that has it in its DNA is Patagonia. And at this year's Bloomberg Sustainable Business Summit, Patagonia Inc. head Jenna Johnson talked about what makes her company's culture different.
Patagonia is a really interesting and unique culture. I've never worked at a company before where the internal employees, the culture is so strong because everyone has very intentionally chosen to come to Patagonia. Certainly, there's a lot of locals who work at the organization, but a lot of people have actually moved to one of our headquarters specifically to work for us because they believe so much in our mission. And when you get that, you get this really special energy humming about the organization as everyone is trying to think as creatively and intelligently as we can about this, you know, massive goal that we're trying to go after in bringing our planet back to health.
Well, and let's talk about, I think it was about a year ago, you guys changed your mission statement, and I want to read it so that I get it right. It went from build the best product, cause no unnecessary harm, use business to inspire and implement solutions to the environmental crisis, to the new mission, we're in business to save our home planet. I mean, you're still adhering to the old mission, but there is no doubt about what's at stake. I know you and I talked in the prep call. I mean, we need to be thinking about our environment because everything we do is impacting it either negatively or positively. And we need to be more positive in terms of impact because there's no going back. If we don't have an environment, then none of this matters.
It's so true. You know, you often hear there's no business to be done on a dead planet, and that's exactly how we feel. As you mentioned, our old mission statement, it was really important to us, and it continues to be really important to us. Those three main pillars are still very much rooted in the work that we do every single day. They're actually part of our B Corp values and our B Corp pillars, mm-hmm. So we are still held accountable to those. But we really felt like although the organization and the company had galvanized around these important pillars, we really knew that we needed to sharpen our focus right now more than ever. We are running out of time. We absolutely need to turn this climate crisis around, and we have to use our business, and we hope others will use their business in order to focus on this. And, you know, we often said, like, yes, the mission statement that we're in business to save our home planet, it is bold, it is fairly audacious, it is, It puts a lot of urgency under each of our steps, and we won't be able to achieve that mission on our own. And our hope is that other businesses see that mission, and we imagine a world in which every business would take on the same mission statement, and then what we could do together if all of us were using our business to influence our individuals, the communities, and bring, again, you know, our planet back to health. It won't happen just with Patagonia. We're not naive to that. But we hope other businesses join us in our mission.
So how easy is it to do? Because you guys are a profitable business. You've been around for a long time. I know you're a private company, so you don't necessarily have to release numbers. You donate 1% of your sales every year to environmental efforts and nonprofits specifically. How easy, or has it gotten easier to be a sustainable company, you know, to create a supply chain that is that way, than it was when you guys and Yvonne started the company years ago?
You know, it's interesting. In some ways, it's easier, and in some ways, it's a whole lot harder. It is not easy. I won't lie. We wake up every day, and we're dealing with probably one of the most complex businesses in the world, trying to be profitable, work in an apparel and equipment industry, and do it in a way that has, you know, zero impact, if not positive impact, on the trajectory of this climate crisis. That is a bold and big challenge every single day we come in to do our business, but it is not impossible. And it actually makes life very interesting. We're never bored, we say at Patagonia. There's always work to be done, always a new challenge to tackle. You know, back in the day when we first started, including in 1993, for example, recycled polyester into our collection, nobody else was using recycled polyester. Was it incredibly difficult? Yes. It took years and years and years of working and building relationships within the supply chain in order to get people to make advances. So in some ways, today, recycled polyester is a lot more available. But the hard part is the more you learn, the harder the challenge becomes. So we know that although recycling is critical and an important part of the waste pollution problem out there, we also now understand a lot more about the impact of our business than we did back in 1993, for example. And so the issues become really complex as we start looking at our carbon footprint overall.
And measuring the company's impact on the environment remains definitely at the forefront of Patagonia's priorities. That was Jenna Johnson, head of Patagonia Inc. Coming up, we mentioned that we had a trio of CEOs that are focusing on sustainability. Well, that includes our next discussion with Chipotle CEO Brian Nickel. He talked about managing through the pandemic. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, someone who I got to talk to a couple of times throughout 2020 is Chipotle Mexican Grill CEO Brian Nickel. He was featured in the magazine as a Bloomberg Business Week Talks this year. He also stopped by for our Bloomberg 50 virtual celebration in early December, just before the emergency approval and rollout of the COVID-19 vaccines. I began by asking if Chipotle would make vaccinations mandatory for its employees.
You know, we would not require people to take the vaccine. Obviously, I would want to do everything I can to make sure that they have access to the vaccine, especially those that are in those high risk groups. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, your health and wellness is ultimately your personal decision. Whatever your decision is, though, if you aren't feeling healthy and you happen to have COVID, we do need you to, you know, take those precautions to not get other people infected. But I'm focused on trying to stay in touch with people so I understand when vaccines get approved, how they will be distributed, and how I best get our employees access to those vaccines. But, you know, at the end of the day, they need to make that decision for themselves.
Well, and I do wonder, too, you know, I think that's really interesting to hear. And I feel like Chipotle has been throughout its history a company that thinks a lot about its employee base. So how do you keep, you know, your employees safe, motivated during these trying times? We talk about, you know, corporate culture when you've got people at home and people all over the place. How do you keep, though, your workers who have to be at work in order to get the job done? How do you keep them motivated during these trying times? And I'm curious if you've made any employee policy changes during the pandemic.
Yeah, look, Carol, I think it, fortunately for us, we've always been focused on our purpose, which is around this idea of cultivating a better world through food with integrity. And we've got some clear cultural values, you know, around basically authenticity lives here, the movement is real, you know, teach and taste Chipotle, and then the line is the moment of truth. And the reason why these values are really important is we've used them to guide a lot of our decisions. We believe our purpose and our values drive our culture. It's why people love to work at Chipotle. And we've been consistent, I think, in all our decision-making against our purpose and our values. And I think it's given a lot of our employees a sense of pride. They love the fact that, you know, regardless of how hard the decision is, we want to do the right thing for our communities, moving our purpose forward, and obviously our employees. So, you know, we were fortunate. We already had a lot of things in practice right, from a wellness standpoint, and, you know, paid sick leave and a lot of employee programs around healthcare, mental wellness, mental health benefits that were available for not just the employee, but their families. So we were trying to surround people with all the right things. And those have been even more important in these challenging times. And, you know, we've dialed up our communication. I'll tell you, the other thing that has really been powerful is we have really worked hard to communicate with every single employee at Chipotle, all 90 plus thousand of them. You know, we're doing Zooms and web calls and telephone calls. I just want to keep them up to date with the most, up to date information. And the more they know, the more they can feel confident that we're making the right decisions and they're working in a safe environment. I've had the pleasure of making some day trips, visiting restaurants, and I can tell you, it really gets you pumped up because our employees are so grateful to be working and to be a part of Chipotle and making a difference in their communities and moving our company and culture forward.
Well, and I'm guessing you're visiting a lot more workers because you guys have been on a significant hiring push. Back in July, you talked about hiring about 10,000 workers. So how has that push gone so far? Where are you in that process?
Yeah, it's been, you know, we're very fortunate. People have been really excited to join Chipotle, and the applications have been, frankly, really exciting to see.
Didn't you get something like 700,000? So we're hiring. Didn't you get something like 700,000 applications or something? It was crazy.
You know, I don't remember what the number is, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's close to right. Yeah. Because we have had, we just had a job for one of our digital opportunities open up. And for just this one position, we had well over, I think 300 or 400 applications, which is really amazing. Now you times that out across 10,000 opportunities from, crew members all the way up to jobs at our support centers. And we've been very fortunate to attract really great people, and we've been able to retain really great people. So We're feeling really fortunate with where we are with the people we have and the people that are drawn to work at Chipotle and apply and want to be a part of what we're doing.
Are you seeing any tightness in the labor market? And I'm curious if you anticipate needing even more workers and if that's going to potentially, if there's tightness in the workforce, also lead to kind of higher wages here.
Yeah, no, we're not seeing an issue with applicant flow. We're continuing to see great access to great talent. I think one of the things why people are really drawn to Chipotle is we have a tremendous growth story. So it's always fun to be a part of a company that when you think about I'm joining today and this company could, triple in revenue over the next decade, double store count, go from 2,600, 2,700 restaurants to 5,000-6,000 restaurants. They're really excited about all the growth, right? Our thing about our digital business, we went from, a couple $100 million to this year, we'll be about probably $2.4 billion worth of digital business.
Wow.
And people love to be a part of companies that have growth. And then what really attracts them here is they feel like it's very much aligned with their personal values. So they love the growth, they love the values, and they're excited to be a part of what our future is. And I keep telling our team, let's just make sure we're hiring the best possible people, but let's also make sure we're hiring the best possible people that really believe in our purpose and our values. And that's where I think we really strike gold.
Brian, why do you think Chipotle has been so successful boosting sales in its digital delivery and delivery business? You guys have just done really well. As you talked about some of the numbers and some of the growth, it's pretty impressive. Why do you think it's worked so well?
I think we have been very focused on keeping the digital execution really simple and mirroring the same experience you get when you come into our restaurants. So, we've tried very hard to give you a digital experience that frankly is almost identical to as if you were in our restaurant moving down the line, picking out, how you want to make your bowl or burrito. And, we've stayed very committed to keeping it simple. Over and over again, what I hear people say is, wow, I love your app. It's so easy to use. And then it's so easy to actually get the food when it's time to pick it up. So, just the aspect of keeping it very simple, really convenient. And then, this has always been at the core of Chipotle. We're really fast and we're tremendous value. So we've just given people another access mode to get great culinary, great ingredients, done exactly how they want it, and, at a tremendous value. So it's working out really well because if you want to order ahead, grab it and go. If you need it delivered, we can deliver it. If you want to run in, move down the line and have that eye-to-eye, contact so you get the burrito exactly the way you want it, we have all these avenues available for you. But at the core of it is great ingredients, great culinary, and then you end up with just delicious burritos and bowls. So, at the end of the day, we are still a restaurant company that is committed to changing food culture.
Hey, Brian, you know, back in March, you did say to me that you thought digital could be about 30 to 40% of your business and be a multi-billion dollar business over the next 3 to 5 years. That still feel about real and likely, or even more perhaps?
Well, yeah, you know, unfortunately, Carol, that was before it became 80% of our business for a time
yeah,
there.
That's
but,
true.
You know, you probably saw in our most recent earnings report, we're in that 40 to 50% range. And, you know, obviously that'll continue to fluctuate as the dining rooms reopen. But I definitely think our digital business is going to stay around as our dining room business comes back.
So it'll stay among that 40 to 50% level, you think?
I think there's a real possibility that's where it could stick. Yeah.
So listen, one thing I got to ask you, Brian, is, and I know all the CEOs we talk to, they don't have a ton of visibility at this point. So I do wonder, what metrics do you look at? Is it consumer data points? Is it, you know, the app, the digital? What are you looking at to get an idea of how healthy the consumer is and maybe what the rest of 2020 looks like at this point?
Yeah, you're exactly right, Carol. There is a lot of uncertainty. I'm sure if you talk to a lot of my peers, we could rattle off the list of all the uncertainties in front of us. What we've decided to really stay focused on is, okay, what are the things we can control? And the things we can control is making sure that we have a really safe environment for our employees to work in, a safe environment that our customers believe in and trust. We know if we do those two things, we continue to get people's trust and then ultimately their business around their meal occasions. And so we continue to really monitor how we as a brand are doing on the things that we can control. You know, are we doing a good job of communicating the safety? Are we doing a good job of communicating why you can feel great about these ingredients, why you can feel great about getting that burrito or bowl from Chipotle? And then obviously we're paying attention to a lot of the macros to understand the health of the consumer.
Right.
And, you know, obviously, depending on where you are in the country, we're seeing a lot of different things. But, you know, for the most part, customers and consumers are still wanting to order food out, whether that's from, you know, their local restaurant or somebody like a Chipotle. You know, we're definitely seeing them fatigue a little bit on going to the grocery store, loading up and cooking all the time.
That was Chipotle CEO Brian Niccol. And that wraps up the first hour of our special holiday weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser. More in our next hour, including the president of the Rockefeller Foundation on forging a resilient economy. Plus, another industry that's been hit hard by the pandemic, we're talking about cruise lines. Carnival Corporation CEO on navigating the financial waves of lockdowns. Also, a deep dive into the importance of mental well-being. We'll hear from the CEO of Verizon Business. And actress Alyssa Milano opening up about her struggles with anxiety. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, I'm Carol Masser. Plenty ahead in this hour of our special holiday weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Some of the highlights from our many conversations in 2020, including Carnival Corporation CEO Arnold Donald on a very difficult time for his company. Also a topic we continue to talk about, and that is the importance of mental well-being during the crisis. We catch up on that with the CEO of Verizon Business. And actress Alyssa Milano on her struggles with anxiety and ways to reverse stigma around mental health. We begin this hour with Dr. Rajiv Shah, president of the Rockefeller Foundation, on forging a resilient economy. He talked with us at the Bloomberg Sustainable Business Summit on how to work on several big problems at once. We're talking about the pandemic and climate change. It's a tall order, and needless to say, he and his team were busier than ever.
This year has been like no other. The Rockefeller Foundation has been around for 107 years and played a role in the pandemic of 1918. So maybe I can't say like no other ever, but certainly in recent times, this has been an extraordinarily tragic year. And it's tragic because basically this crisis, COVID-19, which is fundamentally a public health crisis, has exposed and exacerbated the deep inequities in the society in the United States and frankly around the world. I mean, we've seen that over and over and over again. Minority communities in the US and around the world are hit so much harder by COVID in terms of morbidity, mortality, death rates, and the like. And we know that economically, the consequences for those at the very top have been, you know, manageable. In fact, America's billionaires have probably gained almost $1 trillion of wealth in the digital acceleration that has been unlocked through this period of time. But most Americans and working families are just getting crushed with 20 million unemployment claims on a regular basis, and with the fact that, you know, I don't know, 60% of American households, more than half, went into this crisis before anyone ever tested positive without the ability to muster $400 to deal with an emergency. Mm. And this has been a critical emergency that has exposed how extraordinarily unstable our society is when it becomes so inequitable.
So how do we, because what I'm finding is we're all talking about, okay, we know the inequities that are out there. They've been there for a long time, but they've been really pronounced in 2020 here. So how do we make sure that when we look back 5 years from now, 10 years from now, we make sure that we have set the course to put us, the world and its citizens, on a better course, that we don't look back and say, we missed an opportunity to help the climate, to help individuals, to make the world more prosperous?
Well, you know, the good news is there's so many times in our history where we have said we're going to reimagine a different future and work to make that happen. And we absolutely have to do that right now. We cannot recover to the status quo or recover to what happened before COVID-19 hit our country and our planet. The reality is that was just too fragile and too inequitable of a society on a freight train towards disastrous climate change outcomes. So we've been asking ourselves, well, how can you reimagine the future? We can actually imagine a future where 2 to 3 billion people who are fundamentally left behind by globalization are brought into a global economy based on big investments in renewable electrification and inclusive growth in country after country. In wealthy nations, we're making those kinds of investments right now. We have to do it smartly. Otherwise, we're going to waste this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to put 20 to 30% of GDP back into the economy in the form of economic stimulus. But the opportunity is there to re-envision the future and build back to a condition that's both more inclusive and fundamentally more sustainable.
Well, and, you know, talk to us about some of the work that you guys are doing, because you, from what I understand, you are making specifically a commitment when it comes to fossil fuels.
Yeah, well, we, you know, I know many of the participants in this conference are investors and business leaders, and we, like other partners within the Rockefeller ecosystem, are making a commitment to effectively remove our investments in fossil fuels. And over time, we manage an endowment about $4.5 billion. Over time, we've brought down our fossil fuel exposure to something very, very small, and we will divest of direct investments in fossil fuels, because it's not consistent with the future we imagine and the future we're working so hard to achieve on behalf of a sustainable planet. In doing so, we actually are following the footsteps of our sister organization, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, and so many other courageous members of the Rockefeller family that have come out publicly as heirs of the traditional Standard Oil fortune, and made the point that society needs to rethink growth, capitalism, and sustainability for the future. So we're proud to follow in those footsteps.
You know, it's interesting. We talk so much at Bloomberg about, you know, you can really make a difference by what you do with your money, how you spend it as an individual, as a corporation, the supply chains you work with, as an investor, what you invest in. We know ESG has really taken off this year specifically. So talk to me, too, about the role of investors in kind of this plan that you envision, this mission that you are setting out, that where we can look at the pandemic, look at the climate, look at the energy poverty that the world, a big bulk of our world, is dealing with, how we can make it better, improve those three pillars. But what's the role of investors in all of this? What's the role of leaders in all of this?
Well, leadership is where this all starts. And investors just have to be more, have to own the leadership mantle much more significantly. If there's one thing we've seen, is you simply cannot count on public sector leadership from government to solve all of our problems. And so, you know, I would encourage all the investors here to just make the simple pledge that you'll look at your portfolio and demand and demand that you're proud of everything you're investing in from the perspective of its overall impact on society. That's ultimately what ESG investing is all about.
And as 2020 showed us, so much can be accomplished when we focus collectively on solving some of the world's biggest issues. That was Dr. Rajiv Shah, president of the Rockefeller Foundation. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, lots of struggles for cruise lines in 2020, how Carnival has stayed afloat amid the new world order. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
Safe to say, one of the hardest hit industries by the coronavirus is the cruise industry. Carnival, the world's largest cruise group, raised billions in the debt market, also sold assets. Now, here's my conversation from late summer with Arnold Donald, Carnival Corporation president and CEO, from the company's headquarters in Miami, where we began with talking about juggling many key stakeholders all at once.
You know, our primary responsibilities and therefore our top priority is always compliance, environmental protection, and the health, safety, and well-being of our guests, of the people in the places we go, and of course, our Carnival family, our shipboard and shoreside personnel. So, you know, the interest of public health is always in the forefront for us. And how do we get people back on ships? When there's social gathering and society has developed the compensating measures that it's comfortable with, that we have effectively mitigated the spread of COVID-19, and then we'll be able to cruise again. Now, there are a lot of people, as you know, Carol, who are ready to cruise right now. And in fact, we're looking at starting up in Europe where the spread has been mitigated substantially in places like Germany and Italy. And we're looking at starting up in September there, and a few cruise lines have. But there's a lot of pent-up demand, you know, for travel in general and especially for cruise.
Well, and what I wonder, Arnold, though, can you kind of drill down a little bit? What are some of the specific protocols that you might put in place to get ships safely back at sea? I've been reading, you know, about different folks and what they might be considering, different cruise lines. They're talking about no buffets, constant temperature checks, constant testing, maybe no excursions. What specific protocols will you be putting in place?
Well, again, as you well know, we have a lot of measures in place already on cruise. Mm-hmm. That often shoreside destinations don't already have or didn't have prior to COVID-19. We do medical screens. We're already doing temperature checks in many cases. We had hand sanitizers throughout the ship and signs all over about washing your hands because we've had to deal with viruses in the over 700 ports and destinations we go to annually for many years. Now, of course, COVID-19 is especially unique because the whole world is shut down. And because of that, there's still a lot of learning around COVID-19. As you know from all the scientists, they're still aligning around epidemiology. They're aligning around testing. They're aligning around the role of testing. The one thing everybody right now is aligned on, though, is that, you know, good personal care in terms of wearing a mask, washing your hands, using hand sanitizers, you know, physical distancing at the appropriate times, but wearing a mask is a great way to mitigate the spread. So for the time being, any cruises that will happen will certainly incorporate some physical distancing and, you know, wearing masks. And of course, what we already have was the hand sanitizers, et cetera. Beyond that, there's a plethora of possibilities, but it depends on the destination, depends on the level of community spread in that destination, et cetera. So there could be various testing protocols. I mean, that's a possibility. For the U.S., it's premature. You know, we're not ready to sail here yet. Obviously, the community spread is still pretty vibrant here in the U.S.
Right.
And we're not in a position to sail here. And we're walking cautiously in the other places, too, because our primary interest is to stand with everyone else in mitigating the spread of COVID-19.
But I did read your Costa Cruises safety protocols, and you talked about 3 tests for crew members before boarding. You also talked about, of course, social distancing, new filters. Entertainment will have more shows on during the day so that there's smaller groups, and then also no self-service restaurants, so no buffets, which for many who go on a cruise, they're pretty used to it. So there are some changes coming.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. For the ones that are going to sail now, we have to be ready, just like hotels today. Any hotel that's open today has to deal with the current situation and the limited knowledge there is. And so for Costa, we are deploying a number of testing protocols. Obviously, for our crew, we have not only testing, but quarantine, et cetera, because it's really important for us to have the crew safe from the beginning and then to keep them safe. And obviously, once we get guests on board, we'll have protocols on board for them.
I do wonder how you do it safely. I mean, Arnold, you know this industry better than everyone and better than most in terms of lay personnel. But I wonder how you do it safely, because there have been some smaller cruise operations that have come out of Europe, come out of Alaska, Tahiti. And I believe there were at least 10 crew members aboard your AIDA cruise ships out of Germany that contacted the virus ahead of you getting ready to kind of get back to the seas. That was in August. So I just wonder, how do you do this safely? Even when some small cruise operations are starting to go back out on the water and still having problems with the virus and people are contacting the virus?
Carol, I think there's two stages. One is you want to reduce the risk of having the COVID-19 come on board from shore. So that's the first thing. So you test and you monitor and you quarantine in the case of the cruise. So the ones you mentioned on AIDA, you know, those crew members were tested before they left their home country, and then they were tested again once they arrived in Germany. And we got some positives. They were then retested again, and in several of those cases, the individuals got a double negative test after that, which meant they had a false positive. And then the others were obviously isolated and quarantined, and so the risk of them spreading it on board was zero because we wouldn't have them sail, okay? Now, once you're at that level, the next question is, what else are you doing to mitigate spread? And that's where all the other practices on board. In the event you do get someone on board who has COVID-19, if it's in society, if it's out there in general, chances are you eventually will have someone on board a ship that will have it. And so the trick then, of course, is to make certain that you are able to quickly identify that, you can isolate the person, and that during the time they were exposed, there was plenty of mitigation of risk protocols in place, so the probability of spread has been greatly reduced. And that's where, you know, wearing masks, physical distancing, washing your hands, using a hand sanitizer, et cetera, all come into play.
Arnold, I do also wonder, you know, what are your plans for passengers and crew members who do get sick in the future? You know the horror stories of ships that were, you know, basically lost at sea. They couldn't find a home port. You, I know, and your team have spent, you know, a long time repatriating, you know, your crew members back home. So what do you do? Will there be a way to airlift passengers off ships? What will you do?
We had to repatriate over 80,000 crew members, and it took us quite a while with borders closed and airlines shut down, et cetera. So it took us several months to effectively do that, but we were eventually able to do it. With regards to now, you know, that was before. Now there's enough understanding. We would not go to a destination where we did not have a plan already in the event that there was COVID on board. We're not going to tie up thousands of people off of one positive COVID case or a couple of positive COVID cases. You know, we would have the protocols in place to ensure, one, that the individual is taken care of, whoever has it, that we can get them the care they need. And then number two, that everyone else is unaffected. You know, we would have some form of contact tracing on board so we know who were the most exposed people. But we have to have those protocols for each destination. We go to 700 ports and destinations around the world. So they're all not going to have the exact same protocols.
Putting in place new measures, just one part of that puzzle. That's Carnival CEO Arnold Donald speaking with me before the rollout of vaccines. You can catch that full conversation on our Bloomberg Business Week podcast feed. Coming up, Verizon Business CEO Tammy Irwin on reducing the mental toll of the pandemic on her employees. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
This week, a special holiday weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, highlighting some of our favorite conversations from 2020, some of the standouts with big thinkers. And that included one that talked about one of the big issues of the pandemic, which, as we know, took, of course, a physical toll on many people, but also a mental one. And I spoke with Verizon Business CEO Tammy Irwin at the Bloomberg Breakaway CEO Summit about this. Her team, though, started dealing with the impacts of the COVID-19 crisis in early January.
I think about where we are almost a year into this crisis. What started as a physical health crisis, I think is increasingly becoming a mental health crisis for all of us as we think about kind of the duration of the COVID crisis and the uncertainty of how long it continues for. I think about when it first started in the first half of the year, I think we all thought if we can just get to summer, it'll be over. And then I think we thought if we can get through summer and we get to school, the school year, kids will go back to school. And now we're like, whoa, when does it end? And we've had to really focus our efforts on how do we create a sense of hope? How do we acknowledge the anxiety and stress that people are feeling? And then how do we try to build an environment that allows our employees to do what they do so well, which is create resiliency? And I'd be clear on what success looks like so that they can lean in and feel confident that what they're doing is making a difference in defining the purpose of what they do every day.
So Tammy, how do you do that? Okay, so mental wellness. I know when you and I talked last week, we live in a society as evolved as we are that it's still uncomfortable for a lot of people to say, it's easy for me to say, I've got to go to the doctor, I've got something physically wrong. But when there's something in my head that's not quite right, it's hard for us to admit as a society. How do you do it, especially when we can't even talk face-to-face, we've got to do it virtually. So how do you keep tabs on your teams that some of the individuals who may be having a tough time?
Yeah, listen, I think it takes a series of things to really open up that dialogue and conversation. You're right, it's not a conversation we want to have in the open. We tend to whisper like, oh, I think somebody is having a hard time. Mm-hmm. I think historically that's how we've dealt with it. And I think that what we're seeing is that we really have to put mental illness, stress, anxiety, suicide, addiction, all of those things into the middle of the table and realize that they impact and affect everybody. And the way that we collectively show up on behalf of how we lift each other up and acknowledge and recognize the stress, care for it, help people get the resources that they need to be successful has been really important. We've actually, in our series of communication that we call Up to Speed, which is how we communicate broadly to our employees around the world. And we open it up, quite frankly, to anyone who wants to participate. But we've done a lot of highlighting of some of the challenges around mental health, around suicide, around domestic violence, around child abuse, around addiction, to really say these are real and they're happening in increasing odds because of what we've all been through in the last year. And here are the resources that are available to you and to your family and to the community in which we live. And I think that's so important that we put a spotlight on it and make it okay to talk about.
So you know too, though, like I work for a great company too, and there's tons of resources. And there's one thing about knowing that there's an array of resources. There's another thing of making sure people kind of reach out and tap into it. So I'm curious whether it's through your line managers, how are you making where somebody says, you seem like you're having a tough time. I want you to, you know, kind of either push them and help them in terms of finding what they need. How do you make sure basically that people who are having a tough time, like tap into the array of resources that you guys are offering up?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair question of how do you really make sure it's doing? And I don't know that you always know that it's happening, but I can tell you that some of the framework that we've created has said we've done a quarterly pulse survey. So we've asked our employees directly, how are you feeling? What more do you need from us as an employer to really deal with the crisis that you're in? We've asked managers to then go through that feedback and work an action plan with their team more broadly and with people individually. We've also used our performance management cycle, our quarterly cycle of performance management, to really touch in with employees and say, how are you feeling about your work environment? Thank you for inviting us into your home to work over the last 6 months, because that's really what employees have done. We've found ways to celebrate the kids, the cats, and the dogs that are in the background of the Zoom calls that we're all in. We've tried to ask parents to take some time to help educate their kids when they get up and get started in the morning. And so we've really worked to try to create that one-to-one relationship, the team relationship, and then a broader framework of the tools that are available. You only know that if you ask the question. And we've created a dialogue of uncomfortable conversations for the purpose of getting comfortable that our employees have what they need to really feel successful.
Checking with colleagues and team members, so important, so key during this time. That was Verizon Business CEO Tammy Irwin. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Still to come, we're going to stay on the importance of maintaining mental wellness. We're going to catch up with actress Alyssa Milano, who shares her own path to mental well-being. That conversation still to come. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
Our next guest is definitely someone you know. She has lived a lot of her life in the public eye. We're talking about actress Alyssa Milano, no stranger, by the way, to mental stresses, something she has also publicly talked about. We caught up with her about that. We also talked with her about getting COVID early on in the pandemic. She began our conversation describing the long-term impact that the virus has had on her.
It's interesting. It vacillates. Some days I feel back to normal, and other days it's like I have a recurrence of the acute symptoms. I was sick with the acute illness for 5 weeks in March and April. And I've just, I have not felt back to normal since then. Some days I feel okay, but really it's just this, like, this incredible, exhaustion. It feels like I have no motivation to physically move my body. And I don't know if that is some sort of mental protection or if it's my body trying to regenerate or what is happening. But I have shortness of breath, heart palpitations. My hair is still falling out. And I have I have this ringing in my ears that is driving me bonkers. So yeah,
not great.
It has not been great. And it's interesting because of all my friends, I have quite a few friends that were sick. There's maybe one out of 12 that feels completely back to normal. The rest are just having these long hauler symptoms. And, so, you know, we find great comfort in each other knowing that there are other people out there going through the same thing. And that makes a really big difference. And I think that makes a big difference in our mental health and in general, just to know that there are other people, you know, that go through similar things that we do.
Well, this is why we're so grateful that you're talking with us and talking about your own mental illness and talking about anxiety. And I want to take a few steps back because from what I understand, just doing a little bit of research and watching some different things and some interviews you've done, you've dealt with anxiety for a long time. Is that fair?
Oh, yes. Yes, but I don't know that I had labeled it as anxiety, mm-hmm. but my earliest recollection, and everybody experiences anxiety differently. For me, I get very, I get in a crisis mode that is very hard for me to break the pattern. And basically it gets to the point that my brain just thinks that's the way it's supposed to be functioning in fight, flight, or freeze. And I should also say is when we're talking about issues that affect the brain, you know, we really prefer to talk about mental health, not mental illness. I think once we start calling it mental illness, that's when the stigma comes with that. And also to try to sort of be conscious of the phrases that we use as far as like, I actually just did it and I caught myself, you know, that the ringing right. in my ears was driving me bonkers. Like all of those things, all of those natural ways of describing things of the past, we sort of have to break out of, I think, in order to break the stigma. But my earliest recollection of being in crisis mode was I lived in South Africa for 3 months in 2000. And it was, you know, only 9 years after apartheid was abolished. And I volunteered in a township in a children's hospital. And I was very strong while I was there. When I came home and had to assimilate, like, that part of me that volunteered and dedicated my time to helping other people and trying to assimilate that with the person that lived in Beverly Hills and drove a BMW, had a very hard time getting back and getting acclimated. And I went through about, and at this time I didn't know, but I would say 4 or 5 months of complete and total panic, anxiety. And for me, I have generalized anxiety disorder and I also get panic attacks. So what that basically means is my base level of anxiety is almost in a panic attack mode. And then my panic attacks are sort of on top of that. So I remember like I went to my general practitioner and I wasn't even in therapy, which by the way,
there was anyone that needed to be in therapy, it was a child actor that survived, right?
Was there anybody around you saying, you know, wait a minute, Alyssa, this isn't right. You shouldn't feel this way chronically. And that would step in.
I mean, my mom was, well, I have a lot of the same characteristics as my mother. She suffers from anxiety. She also has dyslexia. Mm-hmm. I have dyslexia as well. So she was encouraging me to go, but I went to my general practitioner and they put me on a very generic antidepressant, which made me, you know, gain 15 pounds. And that was like a whole other issue. And plus I was working 80 hours a week. I was working on Charm. And so it was very hard to take that sort of break and self-care.
I want to bring you forward a little bit, because from what I understand, it really became, I guess, very debilitating after the birth of your son, Milo. Tell us a little bit about what happened, right? You came home and I know there were some complications or some stress just before he was delivered. Tell us what happened.
So I was in labor for 18 hours. I pushed for 3.5 hours and he came to us via C-section. The birth itself was, and the labor itself was very traumatic. Not to get too graphic, but when a woman says she pushes for 3 hours, it is with the help of nurses who are basically trying to manipulate the baby while it's still inside of your body to get the baby out. So for me, it felt incredibly invasive and traumatic. And I think that it triggered my sexual assault trauma.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because I was sitting there and I was thinking, why does this feel like such a violation? Why is this does not feel, and I don't think women talk about this at all.
And you're not in control and it's right. You're not in control. It's a very tough situation, very heated.
And there's lots of people coming in the room and plugging things in. And like, you know, my mom used to joke, like if they had a car in there, they'd be backing that in just to like, so that I think is what triggered my postpartum anxiety. And then I had, I felt better. My milk came in. I felt better. I had this beautiful little delicious baby. And it was when he weaned himself very suddenly without any like going down. My hormones were out of control. And that's when my anxiety started to come back again, was when my hormone level dipped after he weaned, which was at 10 months. So then I had this experience where go ahead.
No. I was going to say, you eventually found yourself in the ER room, right? At, you know, in the wee hours of the morning.
Yes. But before that, the part of the story that I think is almost the most important is I went into my OBGYN when this first started happening. And she looked at me and with a straight face, she said to me, well, it's a big life change. Go for a hike. Try to find some self-care time. And by the way, she said to me, you're 38 years old, so if you want to have another baby, we should probably start thinking about that. And I remember so clearly just being in tears, and I looked at her and I said, I'm not sure I want the baby that I have right now. And you're talking to me about another baby? So I felt completely like the health care that I was getting was totally not where it should have been. So I would just go to the emergency room. I would go to the emergency room every time I felt like I couldn't deal.
Well, and one of the times that you went, you actually had yourself committed, right? For 3 days.
I did.
Why did you do that? Why did you know you needed to do that?
So at the time I was working on Mistresses, which was a show on ABC. And I was still functional and I was still able to learn my lines and show up for work. And the thing about mental health and when you're struggling with mental health issues is you can't see it, right? Someone looks completely together and healthy. And so I knew that the only way that I was going to get adequate care, that the production would understand that I needed to take time off. Mm-hmm. Only if, and I think women feel this in every industry, if they could see the severity. And I didn't think that there was a way for them to see the severity without going into a facility for 3 days. And I have to tell you, that experience really saved my life.
That's something she's working to change, how society responds to mental challenges and reversing some of the stigma associated with it. That was actor, producer, UNICEF National Ambassador, New York Times bestselling author Alyssa Milano at the 2020 Bloomberg Equality Summit. And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser. Be sure to tune in to our daily radio show Monday through Friday starting at 2 p.m. Wall Street time. Be sure also to check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And that's where you'll find our Bloomberg Business Week Extra. This week, it's with Josh Jacobs, co-founder and CEO of Speakeasy Company. It's a digital business for those looking to sell alcohol and merchandise online. And don't forget, we're also on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News. This is Bloomberg.